Delicious meat, nutritious. Crack into a good source of protein with tasty, healthy, Wonderful Pistachios. Wonderful Pistachios is a complete protein, providing all 9 essential amino acids. In fact, each 1 ounce serving of Wonderful Pistachios contains 6 grams of protein. Pistachios have got to be the tastiest nut. Pistachios are delicious, they pack a nutritional punch, and are oddly fun to eat. It's like a little dopamine drop every time you hear that shell crack open. Personally, I like them roasted and salted, but you can find your favorite shell or no shell variety at WonderfulPistachios.com. Whether you are running between meetings or dropping off the kids, Wonderful Pistachios are the snack that works as hard as you do. Check out WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more about this healthy, tasty snack. Did you know your actual age may not be the same as your biological age? That's right. It's not just about your birth date. Your body could be older or younger than you think. That's where True Diagnostic comes in. With their True Age test, you can discover your true biological age, plus get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. And the best part? It's all done from the comfort of your own home. No prescriptions, no lab visits, just a simple test sent right to your door. I just ordered my True Age test, and I'm excited to see what it reveals about my health. I've had ups and downs over the years with my health, and I've embraced the process to stay open-minded and continue to learn about how it can shape its course. I'm curious to see these results because in my mind, I often feel very young and even childish. But there are days my body has its own opinions on the matter. By tracking your biological age, you can actually see how the changes you make, whether that's exercise, diet, or sleep, affect your health over time. It's about taking actionable steps to improve your well-being. Ready to find out your biological age? Right now, my listeners can get 20% off their entire order at TrueDiagnostic.com by using code MINDFUL at checkout. That's TrueDiagnostic, TrueDiagnostic.com. Just use code MINDFUL to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off that 20% discount. Discover your true age today.
The situation of high stress that would be pumping out cortisol, and cortisol will release any stores of sugar in the body. So that would be classically the liver, could be coming out from the skeletal muscles. So it's pumping out because, of course, the body's situation of dealing with stress response, acute stress, whether somebody's ill, is to have lots of sugar available to be able to react, to respond to some emergency situation. So I'm not surprised that not eating for a few days, there is still a high level of blood sugar on testing because of the body's acute stress response. That's absolutely the case.
Dr. Sui Wong, thank you for joining me on the Mindful Movement podcast today.
It's such a delight to be here. Thank you for the invitation, Les.
You're a neurologist, a neuro-ophthalmologist, and an author of several books. I'm always impressed when people could write multiple books. I recently watched my wife go through writing her first book, and after seeing what it took, it's amazing to want to do it after you've done it. So I applaud you for all your efforts there.
So kind. Thank you so much. And in line with your mindful movement listeners, I'm also a yoga teacher.
Oh, okay. How long have you been doing that?
So I became a yoga teacher probably about, time flies. What year are we now? Maybe about 10 years? 10 years? 20, about 10, 15 years, something like that.
Okay.
And I started doing a lot of mindful movement aspects, bringing it to my yoga classes, bringing in hypnotic kind of body scans, and then delving more into various movement aspects as a movement coach and such things. But my day-to-day, as you have mentioned, is a jobbing doctor. So I'm a neurologist and neuro-ophthalmologist.
Okay. So neuro-ophthalmology, can you just briefly describe what that is?
So it's the study and treatment of conditions related to vision. Vision disturbance coming from the brain, or the coordination of movements of the eyes leading to problems like double vision, or messaging coming into the brain like damage to the optic nerve, like optic neuritis, or disturbances from the brain itself, whether it could be vision disturbance arising from migraine causing vision disturbance or other rarer conditions such as visual snow syndrome and other types of visual conditions. So a huge range, really fascinating area. I love my job. It's very much based on neurological aspects. So I am a neurologist, and after I finished my neurology training, I just wanted to do that further focused area with vision. So I do, vision as my main focus in neurology.
Okay. That's fascinating. You know, I've learned over the last few years some really interesting aspects of how vision affects the brain and then from there, everything else potentially.
Yes.
And those connections are intriguing. I know that I've done a lot of like nervous system work where the eyes are like the tool that you're using. Can you elaborate how that's connected?
In terms of the vision and the nervous system?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think of vision as one of the main sensations, one of the sensory information that really is designed to protect us. It's designed for us to look out for whether there's danger, whether there's safety, for us to maneuver around the world. A large part of our brain is involved in vision. And of course, there are the specific pathways. For example, in my clinics, I could see somebody who has had a stroke or had a brain injury or a brain tumor, causing them to lose half their vision. Half of their visual world may have gone because of the damage to the pathways. Or it could be related to conditions where there is a difficulty in interpreting what's seen. So there are people with very rare forms of dementia where they see things, but they can't tell what they're actually seeing. They can't distinguish, say, a pen on a table with lots of things. So there is that sense of confusion about what they're seeing. And of course, there is the day-to-day function in a non-disease situation where we need to watch out for any signs of danger, anything that's coming. So I think vision is a really, really, really big and important part of how we function day-to-day. Hmm. In terms of the autonomic nervous system, it's of course there as part of our vigilance and awareness protection mechanism. So in some situations, people may start getting very alert with everything that they're seeing with their vision because of this heightened sense of vigilance.
Okay. It's interesting. You mentioned a moment ago about seeing things that aren't there, like a pen on the table and being able to differentiate. I have a family member that's been suffering with Parkinson's.
Yeah.
And one thing that's been really stood out over the last few years is that, like, seeing things that aren't there, always trying to pick up things off the floor that aren't there, or it's like you could tell that what he's seeing is very real to him, but it's obviously not there. Is that like a mechanism of something that's trying to help him survive, a protective mechanism that is just backfiring, or the wiring's just, there's just something off with the wiring between what the eyes are taking in and what the interpretation is?
In that specific scenario, you use the word Parkinson's. It sounds like it's either Parkinson's disease or disease that is very similar to Parkinson's, such as Lewy body dementia. So there are certain types of neurological conditions where people get hallucinations. So hallucinations, seeing things that are not there, but actually feeling very real. So the very classic type of hallucination that's seen in the condition of Lewy body disease or advanced Parkinson's disease could be seeing small animals or small children, very classic type things, or seeing as if, oh, something's just run past, like a little animal just ran past them, but when you look, there's nothing actually there. So that's the category of what I call hallucinations. And that one would be, I think, part of the neurodegenerative situation where people are seeing things that's not there. What I just described with the dementia of people can't identify what they're seeing is a slightly different type of neurological condition where they are actually seeing it. So they're registering what they're seeing, but it could be like the clutter of things where usually our brain can make sense of, okay, there is a pen amongst lots of books and phones and things on the desk, but it can't actually distinguish each part of it. So that could be a specific form of neurodegenerative condition where they can't actually interpret what they're seeing. So there are different categories, so to speak.
Gotcha. You also mentioned a moment ago about that there was a relationship between like visual disturbance and headaches or migraines. And I think you alluded to the fact that one causes the other. I forget the order, but can that go both ways? I know that my wife will have a situation where she'll get a visual disturbance and then soon after she'll get a headache. And we've been trying to pinpoint what could be causing it and what stress is kind of affecting her. Is that something you work with commonly?
Yeah, very common. It's one of the commoner, meaning it's more frequent, because migraines are really very common. And in fact, it's so common that people don't realize it's the third most disabling disease when we think of broadly. And for young women at working age, it is the most disabling neurological condition. Yeah. So there are research surveys out there from the WHO, the World Health Organization, and other migraine foundations looking into this data. Because sadly, migraine is a invisible condition. People don't actually see, somebody's experience of migraines. So from the experience of migraine, there could be different stages. The different stages could, the very obvious one that people know about would be the pain of the head, usually in its most dramatic form. People will be shutting themselves in a dark room. They are vomiting because of the migraine attacks. That's the most dramatic form, most obvious form rather. But it's not like this for everybody. So there are different stages. There is the stage where it's called the premonitory or the pre-headache phase. So that could start with something like feeling a bit heavy-headed, a bit foggy brain, yawning, some food cravings, just feeling not quite right, or thirst. You know, these are some of the premonitory or warning symptoms. And then there is the aura phase. So aura classically would be the vision disturbance. So some people may see a little area of zigzag lines that start from the corner of their vision, either the right side or the left side, most commonly from one side, I mean. And then it takes about 5 to 10 minutes to reach its peak. And when it's peak, most people will notice that half of their visual world would be affected. So in other words, if they look through the right eye only, covering the left, they see half their visual world gone. And then they cover the right eye, look through the left only, the same right half of the visual world is gone. So the half is the right half or the left half of the visual world. And the whole thing takes about 20 minutes, classically 20 to 30 minutes to resolve. And that would usually be followed by a headache phase. So could be a throbbing pain and of different severity. Some people get it really very severely, some a very mild type of setting, and that would be usually linked with nausea, sensitivity to movement. That's why most people with migraines tend to prefer to lie still if they can. And there could be sensitivity to light. So that's another vision manifestation, a lot of sensitivity to light, hence the need to be in a darker room, increased heightened smell, sensitivity to smells, to sounds, going to in a dark room is part of that. And then for some people, having a little nap could be really helpful at that point as it's starting. And then there's the resolution phase. The resolution phase also would be oftentimes linked with a post-headache phase, which would be, again, mood is changed, thinking is not quite right, can't quite get the right words, lots of dizziness is another aspect of it. So what people don't realize, which is why I feel so passionately about supporting people with this, is because first of all, it's invisible. Secondly, people are really debilitated by it. And that's kind of the condition, the situation where I see, where people have a lot of vision disturbance or a lot of change in their cognitive, their way their brain functions, and people can't quite get to the bottom of it. And then we realize it was migraines.
So what's happening there? Like on the inside, you say it's invisible, meaning it's invisible from the observer outside. Is it invisible like in the lab, in a science place? Like, do they see something going on when the brain is studied? What's going on?
Oh, it's fascinating. There's a lot of progress with migraine research over the past 20 to 30 years, understanding that it's a neurological basis to it. And it's a lot of it is to do with integration of sensory regulation at the level of the base of the brain called the brainstem. And of course, there is a little further network around that. So it's not just in the brainstem. And there is this phenomenon I mentioned about how people get the aura of the visual aura. And takes about 5 to 10 minutes to spread. And it has been shown in research study that electrical activity, what we call cortical spreading, so from looking at the electrical activity, there's a whole wave that spreads across the brain to create change, which kind of reflects how people are seeing a change in their vision, or maybe for some people, they feel a loss of feeling kind of going across in their body. So yeah, so there is actually a
neurological basis. I'm sorry, when you say electrical, are you saying the brain is creating an electrical signal that's being emitted through the brain?
Yeah, there's a little wave that goes through, like a little discharge that goes through. I mean, basically we can see a change.
Is that the response where the body's trying to address what's going on? Or are you saying that's causal to the problems that, like the symptoms that are experienced?
That would be a manifestation of migraine, and that would lead to the symptoms, yes. So exactly. That what I just said about the spread of electrical activity through the brain, we can see that kind of going along with the visual aura, for example. So that kind of fits in with that. Our body is all electrical, of course. You may have heard about the electrical activity of the heart. People talk about doing EKGs. We can measure electrical activity. We can also measure the electrical activity of the brain. So you may have heard of people having tests to measure their brain waves, whether it's looking for conditions such as epilepsy or conditions such as sleep stages as people are sleeping. So we all have a natural electrical activity rhythm in our body. And what's the interesting about the migraine aura is that there is a little spread throughout that goes. And you can see that kind of explains why people do have this wave of symptoms.
Do you think some people get headaches or migraines because of the, like, all these electrical fields that we're kind of swimming in, like whether it's like all the non-native electromagnetic frequencies people are talking about, whether it's from, you know, cell phones or Wi-Fi or all the stuff that we're like bathing in? Could that, because those are sending out electrical signals, and you're saying that when they look at the brain during a migraine, they're seeing electrical responses. Do you think it could be some type of interaction between these environmental, these like electrical environmental components that are around us all the time?
That's a great question, Les. If we go back to the basics of understanding what migraine is, we know that it's related to a genetic tendency. So a genetic tendency that people tend to inherit. So you mentioned about your wife. So probably most people that when they have a history of migraine, they kind of go back, they have a sibling or a parent who gets headaches. Or sometimes it's really obviously migraine, but sometimes it's not clearly previously known that it was migraine. They thought, okay, it's just headaches, normal headaches. But there is a genetic tendency
too. Are those genes identified? Like which they are?
It's a huge collection of them. So there is no single one gene. It would be a case of a genetic tendency. So it's
I got to ask you then, because if there's a strong genetic component to it, and our genes don't really change, like we have the same genes of when we're born, why would somebody like in their 40s all of a sudden have these?
Absolutely. There is this concept of epigenetic factors, and sometimes switches turn on. And it's a case of it could be influenced by other aspects in the environment. So the key thing to know about migraine is although people may have a genetic predisposition to getting it, not everybody would get it. And oftentimes a case of breaking the cycle to getting back on in control of repeated migraine attacks is to deal with the other factors. So the way I think about it is like this. I think of migraine attacks like a pot of boiling water that has overboiled. So you're on a stove, so you have a stovetop and the water's overboiling. So let's think of that as an analogy of migraines. And in order to stop it from overboiling. Some people, you know, we could pour cold water on top, or we could open up the lid. So pouring cold water, you know, we can think of it like taking painkillers or a triptan or one of these acute migraine medication. But of course, we can't keep pouring cold water on top because it will overflow again. So same concept of why taking painkillers regularly could cause more headaches. There's a condition called migraine medication overuse headache, and it just makes it more and more likely to get headaches and migraine. So the way to deal with it is to turn down the fire, to deal with the other factors that could be influencing this. So the key factors, I would say, would be a lot of lifestyle things that we can delve into in a moment. And to answer your question about what about the electromagnetic fields and all the phones, one would have thought that if the foundations of things are really sorted, like, you know, turning down the fire with all these other, there may be less triggers from electromagnetic waves, for example. But certainly, I have come across people who are very sensitive to the environment, which makes sense. So for those people, you know, a case of trying to reduce a lot of the electromagnetic frequencies could be helpful for them. But it's not something that is the same for everybody across the board, which is right. Why it's so important to delve into the individual's history, ask them about their experience and supporting them appropriately.
When you mentioned that it's a genetic tendency, but the epigenetics, which are basically these switches that are affected by environmental things, whether it's our external environment or internal environment, like that raises a question of what are these triggers? And, you know, that's just that's an obvious environmental trigger that would affect, I guess, gene expression at an epigenetic level. I mean, one of the reasons I asked my wife, who has been, this is, you know, fairly new to her, she's, there has been a Wi-Fi box that was put in a workspace where she spends time. So we're trying to draw that connection and figuring out what's the best way to intervene here. And I'm sure there's other, you know, things that could affect headaches for sure. I mean, I'm sure people got headaches before Wi-Fi existed. But being that, you know, when I hear you say they see an electro cascade or whatever through the brain, well, like anything that could affect with an organism electromagnetically or whatever, you would think can have that, can interact in some way. You know, I wouldn't say that it's inherently negative, but my guess is there's a lot more we don't know than we do know about
Absolutely.
These, like, relationships between us and our environment on an electromagnetic level.
Yeah, absolutely, which is why I think it's always important for us to be open, to ask questions, to be curious, and to really ask and figure out whether something that we did not know about is a new piece of information for us to explore, rather than just immediately debunking something because Right. we don't understand it. Absolutely.
So what's happening on in the visual part of this? So you have like a pre-headache phase, you have a visual disturbance, then you have like the main headache, the pain,
yes. Yes.
and then, I don't know, the after, the hangover of the headache where yes. you might be brain foggy or whatever.
Yes.
So what's happening on that visual spot thing? Is that like an inflammatory response in the nerves in the brain that connect to the eyes, or what's going on that distorts somebody's vision?
I think ultimately we do not fully understand it. There are some potential mechanisms here. It could be an inflammatory response. It could be an energy deficit response.
Oh, interesting.
Which is why I actually, a lot of my interventions, I talk about the importance of metabolic health. So ways to manage the stability of blood sugar swings, to manage our response to insulin and blood sugar. That is a big part of the way I help people. And of course, you know, so that could be that. That could be the question of, is it detoxification pathways? So I think there are different potential pathways for different people. And then we come to what can we do to help? Because sometimes we may not be able to understand fully which is the most dominant mechanism for one individual, but we know that certain things, certain lifestyle modifications can have huge benefits in multiple pathways. For example, one of the key things, so I take this approach, I like to take a systematic approach that tackles two aspects. One is to build the brain resilience, and the other one is to balance the autonomic nervous system. So the building brain resilience, there are a few foundations to that. That includes good quality sleep, because that really helps with various things from detoxification to emotional regulation to inflammation and various aspects, so and so forth. But sleep is one of it. We have physical activity, different types of physical activity, depending on what stage people are with their migraine, how they are in their general health, how we can introduce that. Nutrition and nutrients. What are we actually eating? What the nutrients are we deriving from that? Do we actually need additional supplement support while somebody is in a very difficult state and deriving things mostly from food? How do we support gut health? Because there is a gut and brain connection here. You know, how do we support it? And then other things like mindset and habits and things like that about behavior change that will support brain resilience. And then, of course, there is the balancing the autonomic nervous system. And from what you shared with me earlier before we started recording, I'm sure your listeners would be familiar with the concept of the autonomic nervous system, which would be the part of the nervous system that controls the automatic parts, such as our blood pressure, our pulse rate, our pupil dilatation, our sweating, you know, these things. And we think of the autonomic nervous system in two parts. We have the part that is just gets us up and going and ready and, you know, in its extreme form, fight or flight, runaway, you know, the what we call the sympathetic response. But of course, it's not always in that most extreme. There is, you know, variations of that. Like when we wake up in the morning, we do need our sympathetic to kick in for us to get up, release some cortisol, get us up and going, or even we are ready for a presentation and such and so and so forth. And then we have the other half, which is the parasympathetic, also classically simplified as the rest and relax, that rest and digest. So that's the part that allows us to unwind, to digest our food adequately, that allows us to have good quality of sleep. So I talk about ways to balance both, which is where the mindfulness comes in. The mindfulness could be different practices. It could be a movement-based practice. It could be a breath-based practice, but very much a mind-body somatic-type practice. We could also bring in visualizations to help with that. And, you know, that aspect is something that I really focus on as well, because both parts, building brain resilience and balancing autonomic nervous system, they're very much interlinked.
Interesting. Can we rewind back about 5 minutes where you mentioned the metabolic health component or the possible energy deficit? Do you think that the visual disturbances style headache can stem from just a lack of like blood sugar or low glucose in the brain, maybe just haven't eaten recently enough? Can that trigger a headache?
Yeah, I think there are some research studies, data to support this theory for sure about the importance of our energy pathways. And of course, blood sugar is our brain's preferred source of energy. And when there are swings of blood sugar, it really disrupts things. You can just imagine, you know, if somebody's driving a car, their gas pedal is going whoop, 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 whoop,
right,
pressing down at its extreme and pulling back. So that would be a kind of a description of the swings, the spikes and crashes of blood sugar.
Gotcha.
So yeah, definitely. So the way I think about it is about how we stabilize that. And what's interesting is that there are things that could cause inflammation related to the swings of blood sugar or relatively high blood sugar. We have a part of our brain called that kind of allows that barrier between our blood circulation in the body and our brain, our blood-brain barrier. And we know that when there is really high blood sugar or really disruptions in the blood sugar, it affects that blood-brain barrier. It just means that there's more likely to be inflammation, more chances of, you know,
why
molecules
is that? If the brain, can I stop there, sweet? Yes. So the brain's preferred fuel source is glucose.
Yes.
So why would having too, like, how do you define too much of your brain's favorite food? Like, why would having an abundance of what it wants be inherently problematic or inflammatory?
Yeah. So with our bodies, there is this concept of homeostasis. There is a level, where it's good. So for example, as you say, blood sugar is our preferred source, but only relying on sugar or too much sugar can become toxic. So it's about that area, the sweet spot where there is a kind of a range that our body can handle. When it gets too much, there could be reactions to do with, too much oxidation, too much reactions going on, and it creates a chain of inflammation. So
when you say toxic, you mean because you're talking about like the metabolic byproducts of having glucose run within a mitochondria to make ATP?
And actually, it's not just that, because oftentimes, if it's hanging around and it's not cleared up, it can cause what we call advanced glycation end products, the AGEs, that in itself can be damaging. So there are lots of downstream effects as well.
And but then, if the blood sugar is high, like this is what I understand. So we have a blood-brain barrier, and that modulates what gets into the brain that's like circulating. So let's say the blood doesn't hold a lot of sugar. You were talking a teaspoon.
That's a range.
Let's say it has a gram too much and it's technically high or whatever. 6 grams instead of 5 or whatever, give or take. Doesn't the blood-brain barrier have the ability to not let the extra little bit that it doesn't want to cross the blood-brain barrier? Like, why would we not have a protective mechanism to, I don't want to say spare the brain, but like protect the brain from a little bit, from a gram of extra sugar?
There is that mechanism to try to spare it. It's only when there's too much where the whole system starts to break down. So we have in our body the hormone insulin that tries to mop things up. So in its initial stages, when people have a lot of swings and spikes of blood sugar, the body will produce more insulin to just like get it back in, get it into cells, clear it from the body in an appropriate way so that the blood and the brain fluid and everything, it's at the right level for optimum function. But of course, what happens is that it's a whole process where there's more and more insulin getting pumped out to try to get it under control, but then there's still too much of the sugar hanging around, and it leads to something called insulin resistance. So there's huge amount of insulin out there trying to mop things up, but then it's not really responding. And then there are all these free radicals from the attempt to clear things. There are the aspects of the AGEs I mentioned, advanced glycation end products, and these are the kind of examples of how there could be a downstream effect. So yes,
Do you believe that insulin resistance, whether it's locally in the brain or anywhere, is from just utilizing insulin?
Oh, too much insulin. Too much insulin. So it's not just in the brain. Usually we start to detect it in the body first.
Saying the resistance. So the body's inability to respond to insulin, you think comes from just having too much insulin?
Too much insulin in response to too much sugar. So the first problem is actually too much sugar. Too much sugar, which could come from eating foods with a lot of carbohydrates, eating a lot of things that's processed, ultra-processed, a lot of hidden added sugars in the foods that we eat. So it gets absorbed in our body. When there's too much of it, there's the attempt to pump out insulin to clear it. But then it's the source of eating, the types of food that is causing blood sugar going really high is still ongoing. So the root cause is, for example, could be dietary, but it doesn't have to be a dietary. It could be other things. Some people, when they are dealing with chronic stress or sleep deprivation, it affects their ability to regulate blood sugar levels. So there could be a lot of swings and highs of blood sugar, and the body is trying to create an environment to mop it up, and the response to insulin could be less effective, for example, in these situations, because it's not just one thing. There are oftentimes a few things. So yes, the most common thing could be coming from the kind of foods we eat. But then the important thing would be, what's the stress level? What's the physical activity? What's the body's...
I think that's a more important thing. I think the chronic stress is it. I don't think it is the sugar. I mean, there's people that have very high carbohydrate diets that aren't insulin resistant. are insulin resistant and don't have an issue with metabolizing the sugar. I've heard, and I'm trying to make sense of all this, but like I've heard theories about how once you have a stress and your stress hormones are elevated, and one of their roles is to partition more substrate to make energy, to meet the demands of whatever that stress is. Part of that process is liberating fat tissue and to make energy out of it. And within a cell, you can't oxidize both fat and glucose simultaneously. So the metabolizing of one suppresses the entering of the other. So when you have stress hormones elevated and you have increased fatty acid oxidation because your body's released it to try to address the stress, then glucose can't get in that mitochondria because there's already fat in there, which raises blood sugar because it's not getting metabolized, which sounds the alarm, which creates a cycle where your body releases more to try to, because it just keeps trying to get glucose. As you mentioned, it is the preferred fuel source. So it's like in this alarm state where, and then it's not necessarily the carbohydrates you're eating, it's that you're not burning them because you're in a stress state. Like some people say, you'll never find someone with like diabetes that's not stressed because the stress came first. I mean, I remember about a year ago or so, my father went to the emergency room and he hadn't eaten in like 4 days and his blood sugar was high. And I remember like, well, that's obviously not from his food because he has no food. He's in this like acute stress state, but people live with a little bit too much stress all the time. I mean, chronic stress is associated with like every disease pathology that seems to take us out. So I'm trying to reconcile that mechanism, which I'm pretty sure exists. And can that be true? And also it be true that just too much of sugar makes you not good at using sugar? Like we wouldn't say that about anything else. Like it's usually a use it or lose it system in the body. So it's not like someone say, well, drinking water reduces your inability to absorb water. I mean, maybe at some point it does if you try to drink, 10 gallons of water, the body will shut down or whatever. But I just wonder, because if the brain really just uses glucose, unless it doesn't have any and it makes a ketone, which it can run on, but that is inherently a stress state because you have to pass through the stress of not having sugar to make the ketone. So really we're looking at glucose. So why would too much of its favorite thing be the thing causing a problem? And when you mentioned that it could be from the increased amount of free radicals from the utilization of that glucose, but why would the body not self-limit? Why would the body run more through the engine than it would want or could tolerate just because there's an extra gram? Like you could put it somewhere else. You could put that gram of sugar in your liver or in skeletal muscle. Like if you could hold 300 or 400 grams of sugar in your muscle, why would one extra gram in the blood make the brain have a problem? Like, why wouldn't the body just say, well, we don't need it in the brain. We could put it somewhere else. But when you see that, you also see stress. So I wonder is like, and I'm not an expert, but my instinct tells me that the stress is the problem. Now, what form that stress is could be a real puzzle to try to find out. And my guess is individuals present very differently. And there's so much like individual variability and trying to figure out, well, what's the stress addressing this person. Like when I think about my wife in this scenario, yeah, she has like this new Wi-Fi thing, but maybe you're right. Like maybe she's teaching 5 classes in a row, so she hasn't eaten in 5 hours and she's talking the whole time. So her breathing is not optimal because she's yep yapping. And because of that, her pot boils over when there's a Wi-Fi because it's like putting over the edge. Maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the kind of observations that you made. So if I could chime in with some observations that could link in with that. I completely agree that chronic stress is a big aspect. It's not helpful, I find, in reality to say, be less stressed. Right. Because that's not helpful.
If it was only that easy. Yeah.
Which is why a big part of the program I deliver is balancing the autonomic nervous system. It's about dealing with that. Absolutely. It's about the stress response. So as part of the stress response, as you gave the example of your, is it your dad, did you say?
Yes.
And I hope he's fine now.
He's recovered, yeah.
Oh, I'm glad.
Thank you.
So the situation of high stress that would be pumping out cortisol, and cortisol will release any stores of sugar in the body. So that would be classically the liver, could be coming out from the skeletal muscles. So it's pumping out because, of course, the body's situation of dealing with stress response, acute stress, whether somebody's ill, is to have lots of sugar available to be able to react, to respond to some emergency situation. So I'm not surprised that not eating for a few days, there is still a high level of blood sugar on testing because of the body's acute stress response. That's absolutely the case. Right. So I agree with that. I can see how that could happen. And based on the comment about how some people, when we see, oh, they can have lots of carbohydrates, they don't have any insulin resistance situation, there could be other things that we haven't explored with their lifestyle. Maybe there's somebody who's really very active and they really need that carbohydrates to fuel the muscles for the activity. So it's a question of what is that person's activity and their lifestyle. And of course, what we don't know is that for some people, when they're younger, there's this concept of, oh, I used to have lots of junk food, you go to the fast food place, have and no problem. And then all of a sudden, I reach 30 years old, suddenly I'm putting on weight around the belly and such things. So there is this concept of a metabolic dysregulation that's not yet apparent. So it's not apparent from somebody's single blood sugar pinprick. It becomes apparent when we know, like, okay, it's leading up to that because the other factors are not protecting them. So if somebody's very sedentary, they do an office job, you know, they don't do much exercise, they don't have much skeletal muscle in their body. And, you know, so that could mean that they get more and more visceral fat. So kind of fats between their organs in their abdomen. So that would put them at an inflammatory state, more likely to develop insulin resistance and metabolic dysregulation before, years later, they get pre-diabetes, for example. And they go, oh, came out of the blue, but actually it started a little earlier. So I think that actually our body is designed to deal with when there's excess of things, when the other things are all right, so that, you know, we're not pushed to the tipping point. Right. So I oftentimes think of a problem like diabetes or even pre-diabetes is really, it's reached a tipping point. And then we kind of have to go, okay, what's relevant here? So it starts off by going, how's the nutrition? Because as you say, it may have nothing to do with what somebody's eating, or it may be just a little bit, but not the main aspect. Then we go into how's the physical body? How is the skeletal muscle? How much movement are they doing? How much stress are they holding? What's the situation with their, you know, their gut health? And how is that relating to the inflammation generally of the body? So yeah, I completely agree. It's not just about not eating sugar, not at all. It's also not about not eating carbohydrates, not at all. It's about addressing what other factors that could be. Sleep is the other thing. You know, if somebody's very sleep deprived, it just makes it more and more likely for them to get other diseases. So how can we support that? And then it's a question of what's affecting it. Could it be that people are thinking about what's happening in the day? They're worrying about something. So then they're kind of ruminating a lot and not actually falling asleep, for example. So hence this important situation of having conversations with people for them to know. Because I always think that the person who come to me, they are their own experts. You know, they know themselves really well. And sometimes it's about having that conversation to help to, you know, help them see as well. Sometimes if we are so used to a certain pattern, we may not notice that, oh, actually, although I go to the gym for half an hour, and then the rest of the day, I'm just in front of my computer, really not eating properly, don't get a lunch break, you know, driving a lot because of the job and feeling stressed because of so many things on my plate. And then it's affecting my sleep. Do you see what I mean? And then
yeah, for sure.
So it's about
Well, let's talk about some of those things. So you mentioned you have like a two-prong approach, like working with the brain resiliency and then managing and balancing the autonomic nervous system. You mentioned like the broad categories of building the brain resiliency, whether it be the sleep or, you know, regulating emotions or nutrition. What are some more specifics under that category, like specific interventions that you feel would be like the low-hanging fruit for many people that can help move the needle?
So I think a really nice low-hanging fruit could either be sleep or physical activity. And I oftentimes see it's one or the other depending on the personality type of the individual.
For sleep, though, like what are the specific interventions that you feel are like the most accessible that have a lot of bang for buck?
So regularity of sleep is a key thing. So having a natural rhythm, because what I would like to support is for people to develop their own brains or their own body's body clock, the circadian rhythm. So when it's time to wake, they feel awake. When it's time to sleep, they feel sleepy. And part of that is getting to a regular rhythm so that then the brain can release the appropriate hormones at the right time. So it would be a case of starting with an anchor of waking time, the morning anchor. So let's say if somebody has got difficulty sleeping or they sleep fine, doesn't matter, then they're up at the same time. So waking up at the same time will allow that regular rhythm for the brain to release, okay, it's time to wake. And then with that, doing other things that will help promote the circadian rhythm. So that could be doing some physical activity, going for a walk or getting exposure to bright light, for example. And then
Mean in the morning, like getting
In the morning.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of signaling to the brain that, okay, now it's morning, hence the, you know, movement or bright light. That would be really nice. And then having the evening sleep time linked with what time they are waking up. So people can work backwards from the morning wake time. So let's say people oftentimes ask, oh, how many hours of sleep do I need? And I give the average in a population. And the reminder is that it's for the population. So of course, we are not an average of everybody. So it's about for somebody to figure out how do they feel when they go to bed. You know, let's say if they're already going to bed at 10 p.m. and they're already waking up at 6 a.m. usually, then I say, okay, aim to keep the 6 a.m. as a regular thing for at least 2 weeks. And then going to bed at 10 p.m., see how you feel after the 2 weeks rather than one day sleeping at 6, waking up at 6, another day waking up at 10 a.m., another way. A lot of the shifting of the wake time makes it hard for people to get to a regular rhythm and figure out how much sleep they need. Most people are catching up with sleep deprivation. So I think if they do that, after about 2 weeks, they have an idea how much sleep they need. And then to get themselves more able to sleep in a more better quality sleep and having more refreshed sleep, then we can start thinking about what is helpful. Whether it's a wind down routine, you know, if somebody is finding that they are ruminating a lot, having difficulty falling asleep, perhaps something that helps them write down their thoughts in a journal that helps them clear their mind. Or it could be that they are holding stress in their body, so they haven't had the chance to move, to stretch, to breathe. So a really gentle, you know, yoga type session could be really helpful. It could be just breath work. It could be just some simple stretches. And that kind of just starts the relaxation of the body. And then we start talking about how much light that they're receiving in the evening. There are two aspects to light. One is the intensity of the light. So if a room is really bright, it will just block the release of the melatonin hormone that our brain starts to release. So it does not, and also it stops the action of it. So how bright something is. And then the second part is blue wavelength light. So it's a case of if somebody is using their computer or using their phone, think of having a night mode so it screens up blue light. And in fact, even think of a electronic shutdown time, because sometimes, although there is a wind down mode, night mode, it's a lot of activation with social media scrolling. You know, I've been there. I kind of go, oh my gosh, 45 minutes later, I'm still on my phone.
Very slippery slope.
Absolutely. So it's kind of having a pre-decision about what would be the wind down time and then what would be suitable for the wind down time. And a tip that I love giving, which seems to be very well received, is listening to something that helps people unwind. So, for example, some people may always get into thinking, problem solving, or worrying mode as they are in bed. And something nice is to be able to listen to a podcast, perhaps this one, or listen to an audiobook on a sleeper mode, a sleeper timing. So then the phone or the device that's allowing that to listen is placed far away from their bed, and then for about 30 minutes, so they're listening to it, and then they fall off asleep. Because most people, when they're tired enough, they will start to fall off asleep, you know, when they're not in thinking mode. So those are the examples, and there's a lot more, of course, we can talk about, of the kind of wind-down routine. So I think that those would be the low-hanging fruit in terms of a regular rhythm.
Do you feel like you see a big difference when people get that morning light to affect their sleep that next evening?
Oh, yeah. I do a migraine mentorship, and there's this lady, when she first started, she, bless her, she trusted me a lot. And we did this. She trusted me so much. And she, it was great because then she really did the work. Because asking somebody to wake at the same time and then going for a walk in the morning is a big ask. It's a big ask. And for her, she did it. And it made all the difference. And she says to me, you know, it's a 3-month program that we do together. And she was like, I never knew I was a morning person. I feel so good. My brain fog is gone for the first time. It's really powerful, that whole morning and movement thing. And yeah, with the light.
I would like to do that more. In the winter here, it's just hard to do. It's like, yeah, I'm up so much before there's a chance to get light. But one thing I do notice really move the needle for me is at night. Like, I do the night mode on the phone.
Yes.
Where it really goes red, and I have a red light. We have, you know, we switch to red light in the bedroom and our, yes, like bedroom, bathroom. And that makes a big difference. Like, it's got to a point now where my brain seems to just get that signal and I get sleepy. It doesn't take long to get sleepy when I'm in a red light environment. And I definitely fall asleep a lot faster. My issues are still more with like the later part of the sleep cycle, like staying asleep in the, you know, once it's like 4 or 5 o'clock and getting that last hour of sleep, that's where I struggle with. But I definitely notice taking the blue light out at night moves the needle. I have a new habit too that's helped. I've been playing classical guitar, and so I always have like homework. I have a teacher, so I've inserted that in that evening routine because it gets me off my phone. I could do it in a low light environment and it's relaxing. Like I do stretches too, and, you know, do some gentle movement, but just taking that like 10 minutes to practice my little homework and give my mind something to focus on. I mean, there's a meditation component, because you can't be somewhere else. Like,
yes,
and maybe you could if you're really good at guitar, but I suck. So like it takes all my attention to be like, hit the right string, play the right note. So that's been a nice addition to my evening routine, where it's it nourishes me in a different way, but it still is like supporting, I think, that evening wind down mode. Well, what about, like, in my case, I'll be selfish here. When someone has no trouble falling asleep and no trouble staying asleep up to a point, but then, you know, wants to sleep till, let's say, 6 o'clock, but is up at 4 o'clock with lots of energy, ready to go. Like, are you better off getting up and riding that wave of energy, start your day and take a nap later if you need it? Or is there something you recommend to try to, like, soak up that last hour or two of sleep?
And a few things I'll be thinking about. So perhaps I could start off by asking, how many hours are you actually getting when it comes to 4 a.m.?
So I'm usually getting in bed around 9:15, 9:30. And once I roll over, close my eyes, I'm out within a few minutes. So I'm definitely asleep by 9:45. And then it's very often that I will get up between, let's say, 4 and 5. And I would like to sleep to 6.
And why would you like to sleep to six?
Because I don't feel like I'm getting enough. Like, I will get tired later in the day. So I feel like if I slept to six, maybe I wouldn't get tired later in the day. And I just, I don't know. I want it because I assume there's good things happening then. Maybe, you know, you raise a good point. Maybe I don't even need it. And I'm chasing something, an illusion of some sort.
I'm asking because I'm
interested. Because I've been listening, because I've read 3 books on sleep. I've listened to numerous podcasts about sleep experts. And you hear all the benefits and the importance of it. So it's like, yeah, I want those benefits.
Yes.
That's why, I guess. My ego wants to sleep.
I mean, potentially you would benefit. I'm asking because I'm quite interested to kind of understand what's happening. And what used to happen before you wake up at 4? Would you actually sleep right up to 6?
I mean, I have a history of, I guess, troubled sleeping. I mean, there's been times where I think I've had gut issues that would get me up in the middle of the night, or, you know, some kind of like health stress. I was low carb for a long time, which definitely disrupted my sleep. And it took me a while to draw that connection there. I used to be a pretty big alcoholic for a long time. I've been sober now for almost 9 years, but you know, that I know disrupted my sleep, and maybe the patterns were set then, but I just never have had a history of sleeping all the way through well. But the first, like, you know, 5 hours of sleep is like always great, like really deep. Could wake me up if you tried. But then that last bit, I feel like I'm being gypped at the end of it and don't know how to improve it.
Yeah, there are a few things I may be thinking about. So, of course, this is not a medical advice situation. It's for your benefit.
I don't know. You're a doctor. I'm taking his medical advice.
Disclaimers. So, for example, the kind of things I would be asking somebody who describes that in clinic would be, what do they think is waking them? So for some people, they may realize that actually at 4:30 a.m., there is a truck outside on the street that is driving past, and it wakes them without them realizing, but it wakes them enough for them to think, oh, I woke up by myself. So that could be one of the questions I'll be thinking about. Is there something in the environment? So it could be sounds, it could be temperature. So our body's temperature starts to rise a few hours before it's time to wake. So the other question I may be asking is, how comfortable are you feeling with your body temperature? Are you waking up because of heat, for example? Sometimes it feels really cold at the start and it feels really hot. And then that could be the reason for waking. And then there could be something else. Yeah, there could be something else. Could be that it's very natural. The first thing to say, it's very natural for us to have little moments of waking as we are sleeping through the night. So for some people, what they can do is they can fall back asleep because they go, yep, they wake up, they turn, and then they fall back to sleep. And that becomes a non-issue. For some people, they may wake up and they are just not settled enough to fall back asleep. So then they are like, wake up, then the brain is already processing, okay, what am I going to do next? What do I have to do? And, you know, so then the brain starts taking things inactively to keep them awake. So those are the examples. Or it could be other physical health things I'll be thinking about. Is somebody waking up because actually they need to use a bathroom? Or do they have something that's causing them to wake, like some pain? Or, you know, various things that I would be explore in depth about somebody. And then it would be a case of, if they want to try to sleep more, it could be a case of practicing some breath work. So preemptive decision is, when I wake up at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m., I will do these 10 cycles of exhale-focused breath, or I'll do this specific type of meditation. And that's what they do. And then they may fall back asleep. If they don't, that's okay. They've done their meditation. So that could be one of the examples. The other thing could be that for some people, the amount of sleep that they need could be less, but what you're saying is that you feel tired. So maybe you would benefit from more. So there are different ways to think about
maybe,
it.
And I don't know, like, maybe that's fine. Maybe it's fine to get up early and then at 2 o'clock, take a half hour nap in the afternoon when you're tired and refresh. Like, maybe there's just no inherent problem with that. And that's a good strategy. I don't know, but I sure would like, I don't know. I just want to know what it's like to get I want to know what it's like to sleep 8 hours straight, and I never do that. The temperature you raise is a very interesting point. So you're saying that our temperature, so I know our temperature falls at the beginning to help us fall asleep.
Yes.
But then you're saying our temperature rises an hour or two prior to waking up?
Oh, the process probably starts about 3 hours before. It does vary, of course, so we're talking about general population, but it slowly rises. So a strategy on the flip side is why I say if somebody wants to wake up at, let's say, 6 a.m. and they feel like, oh, I just want to stay in bed, it may be starting the heating, the central heating, a bit sooner so that by the time 6 a.m. comes, they feel a bit warm and it's like time to get up. That sort of scenario.
So that's something I could tinker with and program the heating and cooling so that maybe it's a little cooler around that time that I would, that I've been waking up.
Yes, and that maybe could be something.
I will play with that. See, that's going to piss off my wife. I have to choose wisely here. We'll see. I'll try it without telling her first and see and see how that goes. And then if it goes poorly, I could just blame you. And I'll give her your contact information.
So. There are a few other things you mentioned. So the nap thing, I do prescribe a nap, especially when people are starting to change their sleep pattern to be more of a regular one, because I talk about the sleep anchor, and that's a big trust with me for them to like, okay, decide on the sleep anchor, because when people are sleep deprived, they really don't want to wake up at 7 a.m. on a weekend because they usually would sleep extra 3 hours. So what I always do in that scenario is I prescribe a 30-minute nap. So if somebody is like yourself going to bed sleep at 9 p.m., I'll probably say the nap at 12 o'clock at midday so it doesn't affect the sleepiness. So there's a hormone called adenosine that is released, and when we take naps, it clears it a little bit so the sleep pressure is reduced. So that would be the situation. There is also something else that some people could do if they can't have a nap. I suggest that they do a little body scan type meditation. So that could be nice. So I talk about the breath work already, or body scan type meditation. All that could be really nice. And I suggest kind of doing one thing and test it out for a bit of time. Of course, this is talking about people who are healthy, who don't have a neurological condition. Of course, in the clinics, I see the other extreme. Some people do have medical conditions, and waking up too early is actually something else. That if a scenario where we investigate, then of course, then people can have sleep studies, you know, kind of diagnostic tools to see what's actually happening, what parts of their sleep is being affected. There is a whole path that one could potentially go down, of course, with a medical provider. But there are also a few things that people can try before they go down that route to see whether it sorts it out. So it's one of those where, you know, if you feel it's time to see a medical provider, go see one, you know.
I would try to dodge that if I can. So as a medical provider, do you just work in person? You're in London, right? Or
yes, I'm in the UK in London.
Okay, so you just work there. Do you work remotely? Do you help people through telemedicine or anything?
So I do my healthcare provision. So if I were to take somebody on as a patient, my doctor-patient relationship is in person. And then after that, I could do a remote consultation after I've met them in person. There are regulations around that. So for example, people in the US or people in a certain country, depends on the whole regulations, I cannot provide remote consultation. I only see them in person. So I'm very grateful that I've got people who fly in from different parts of the world to London to come and see me. So that's for their neurological situation, or they want to see me as a patient. I also do online programs. So I mentioned about the mentorship. So I do education programs, and that's very well received because I have a wider reach. And actually, that's the motivation of me starting these things, because I mentioned I'm a neurologist, neuro-ophthalmologist, but really a lot of my work is integrative approach. I do a very lifestyle-based approach and people really like it. So with the opportunity of the online platforms to deliver courses, to deliver mentorships, people work with me through the education platform.
And where is that? How do people find out about your online programs?
So people can reach out to me. I have a newsletter and a way that they can sign up or put a comment to be updated about one of my online programs. At the moment, I'm focusing on migraine-type programs, but I will be expanding that out to other brain health-related programs with lifestyle approach. So I have a newsletter. I call it Thursday Tips. So every Thursday, people get a very short newsletter. It's 1 minute to read, where I share three tips and I leave the reader with one question. I'm so grateful. It's very well received. So it's all about this kind of brain health, lifestyle-based, holistic approach type tips.
Where do people go to get on that list? What?
So they can sign up through my website. My website is drsuiwongmd.com. So that's drsuiwongmd.com. And then they can click the link on the homepage. There is a Get My Thursday Tips newsletter.
And do you have a few minutes to just talk a little bit about the books you have? So
yes, thank you.
I noticed before we started, I saw you had a couple in the background there. What's like your most recent book that you are working on?
The most recent one I'm really excited about is The Sweet Spot for Brain Health. So it's actually about the importance of metabolic health and how we manage it to optimize our brain function. And as we had alluded to, it's not actually just stop eating carbs. Right. And it's also not just about food. It's also the other lifestyle basis. And it kind of goes into lots of practical strategies. I do like the approach of being practical for people to implement, because of my with me being a jobbing doctor, neurologist for 25 years now, a lot of my experience is helping people create sustainable change that creates transformation.
Do you feel that's well received? So you have this integrative approach where you are really factoring in the lifestyle, but you have this, I guess, more formal, traditional background medically. Do you find that your ideas are really well received in those like older, I guess, structures in the medical field?
Amongst my colleagues, it took a bit of convincing at first, to be fair. And I was also quite nervous about talking about things like lifestyle-based approach to help their medical conditions. But then I realized that there is a whole evidence basis to it. There are societies, medical societies, and there are diplomas. So, for example, I got the diploma of lifestyle medicine with the International Board of Lifestyle Medicine, for example, just to find a way to say, oh, there is actually a whole thing out there. It's properly accredited, for example, and about bringing in interventions that creates an evidence basis. So, for example, when I deliver a program that I see people through group setting to be able to support behavior change, it's been really well received by the patients, the people with their medical conditions, and by my hospital, because it was an innovative approach. I was showing evidence for it. I was collecting data, and it was developed with patients. And it's really much, a lot of my work is very much about helping that patient voice for them, for us to deliver something that's appropriate for them, and keeping an open mind. Like I said at the early stage, just because we don't understand something, maybe we just need to ask questions to understand.
Right.
And of course, one of the things that I started doing, which I think was probably how it came to this podcast, was mindfulness. So yeah, I mentioned the yoga teacher thing, but I didn't really bring that part into my hospital medicine until I started evolving more into, okay, how do I actually bring it in? And I thought, okay, mindfulness approach would actually be a really good way in. But then I didn't want to say, oh, I'm doing it because I'm a yoga teacher, because of course I needed some other additional certification, so to speak, in the medical context.
Gotcha.
So I then got training to deliver mindfulness-based cognitive therapy or mindfulness-based interventions. And then, you know, this mindfulness thing came in through research. I started delivering research to show how we can use mindfulness to change some people's visual experience, change brain pathways, which was the thing that inspired me to write this book, my first book, Mindfulness for Brain Health. It's a topic very close to my heart about mindfulness, about how we support people to implement mindfulness really as mindful moments.
Gotcha.
Mindful moments throughout the day, and to support their well-being.
That sounds fantastic. So it also sounds fantastic that you have a group setting for your patients, for them to support each other. My guess is the whole process individually is more successful because they have that connection with others going through something similar.
Yeah, it touches me all the time when I do it. Because initially I did it out of desperation. There are so many people to see in my clinics. The waits
are manage time.
Hours. And it just got really bad where I had a lot of patients I couldn't fit into my clinic. I would keep adding them as extra. So a clinic would run an extra 3 hours late because I was adding so many patients. And of course, it was not sustainable for me. And it was not a good experience for people to be waiting for so long in the waiting area just because I had doubled the numbers. And there was only one of me. And I realized that there was this potential approach of a group clinic. And I started doing that with some patients, got their input into it. We started doing it together. And then it kind of built from that. It's been 5 years now we've been doing that. It's phenomenal.
That's great. That sounds like a great idea. I would love to see more of that stuff over on this side of the pond. And I think that would be just overall better for human connection and society and everybody's individual healing. I would guess would be more successful overall. Well, Sweet, I really appreciate that you reached out and I really enjoyed the conversation with you. And there's a lot to go on here. I know we could spend a lot more time on some of these topics, but I feel like we touched on a lot of things today and I really appreciate you taking the time to discuss them with me. And is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap this up?
Yes, just to say thank you. It's been such a joy to be able to be here to have this conversation. And I hope that your listeners can connect with me. I mentioned my websites, so they could either join me on my Thursday Tips newsletter. They can write to me. I like to correspond with people who respond to my newsletter. Or there is also a listing of my books as well, either on my website or on Amazon, for example.
Okay, and we'll link to all those in the show notes. Well, Sweet, thank you once again. And for the listeners, always grateful for your listening. Please share the episode if you feel like you know somebody that would benefit from it. And, you know, if you have more questions, reach out to Dr. Wong and see if it's a good fit to work with each other. And I guess I hope you all enjoy your day. Bye-bye.